Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Anthony Lane. His collection, Nobody's Perfect, was recently published by Knopf. He is the film critic, one of the two film critics for The New Yorker, and he does a variety of other things for them as well, essays on books as well as profiles. In fact, although he doesn't say so, the profiles seem to be his way of reviewing old movies in the same way that the book section is his way of turning to the authors he seems to like the most. Are these your favorites? Do you get a fairly free hand?
I think I get probably too free a hand, in fact. I sometimes think they should be much sterner with me. And whenever I go to the editor and sidle up to him and say, look, I really want to write a piece about Thomas Pynchon or W.G. Sebald, I think he should turn around and say, you know, go back and finish your work and come back when you're properly behaved, you know. I'm not sure I should be given such a free hand. I think everybody who's interested in writing to some extent has a little catalogue, perhaps rather a secret catalogue at the back of their minds, people they'd like to write about. And over a lifetime of writing, you know, you will find these people come up, you know. If you miss the new Raymond Chandler biography, there'll be another one along another 10 years or whatever. What's interesting to me, going back through the book, in so much as I can bear to reread my own prose, it's like going through trunks of old embarrassing clothes, isn't it? Is that the people whom one approached already knowing something of the subject aren't necessarily people about whom one was happiest to write. For better or worse, and this is something that one perhaps shouldn't admit in public, I spent a long part of my earlier life as a student writing about T.S. Eliot, and which nowadays is it's like saying that you were in the Wehrmacht or something, but I might as well admit it. And when it came to Eliot actually coming up in conversation because, you know, there's a new collection of letters, or there was a new movie, or in this instance because there was a collection of the early poems published, I sort of leapt on it, of course, ravenous, and saying, my God, this is the guy I want to write about. And in fact, I found it very hard. A lot of journalism is to do with writing about... is to do with knowing just enough, or with knowing a little bit more, with a little free space around the edges, or to having to find things out very fast, not just in literary journalism, but you know, more obviously in grown-up journalism, as it were. And in this case, I came already fairly well-armed. There's lots I didn't know, but I'd been toiling in the Eliot vineyards for a long time. And there's no guarantee that this will lead to... For the long essay, for the 5, 6, 7,000 word essay, maybe you may have too much clogging your brain. The piece can come out clotted. You may have too much to say, and you may lack that sense of excitement that comes from coming up from you know approaching a new author or a new interest, you know, sneaking up on them and having to surprise them and surprise oneself. So there was a point which I was in the offices of The New Yorker and I was passing a doorway and somebody said, hey, Anthony, come in. Do you want to write about Shackleton and the explosion of Antarctica? And I said, I don't know about it. And they said, great, off you go.
Well, among American film critics, the one you remind me most of is the one who was most dear to me. That was Dwight MacDonald.
Yes.
He was a teacher and a friend. And among his most prized accomplishments, I think that there was nothing he liked as much as editing the Book of Parodies and writing the introduction to it. And it seems as if humor of various kinds is a second hobby.
Well, I don't think it's a second hobby. If it was a second hobby, I could lay it aside and pick it up or go into the humor room, as it were, the rumpus room, when I wished. I'm sure it's a deep flaw in my nature, but I find that, you know, humor comes looking for me often in ways when I don't want it around, and it's nipping like a terrier at my heels. There are very few occasions in which it doesn't make its presence, doesn't want to make its presence felt, regardless of whether I'm capable of summoning it or not. It's interesting you should say parody, because I'm very keen on parody. I was taken to be a good, at the very least, a good practice piece. Most of the poets and composers whom I like started off as, amongst other things, accomplished parodists. Not out of any desire to mock. We know that parody is an act of love as much as anything else, as much as an act of lampoon, more so, I think. But also because it's a skill. I mean, Ezra Pound said you should try and write a sonnet every day, and as you should practice your scales. The one thing I do in the book, when I do overt parody, is that there's
the
no
Jane
point.
Austen,
I do a Jane Austen reviewing a Farrelly Brothers movie, which is, let us say, an unlikely mismatch. Parody only works if there's something, if you still have a subject. You can't just sit down and parody as a gesture of empty style. It was fun to do that because I actually had to review the movie. I did once have an idea that I would do this with reviewing food. So you could go to kind of like a fish restaurant, review it in the style of Melville. But that's, you know, perhaps awaits another day.
I once wrote Moby Dick in the style of Deanna Vreeland. It was called MD by DV.
Well, I'd like to have seen Moby Dick up against Miss Vreeland. It would have been an interesting contest, I think.
It was in the Atlantic.
Her harpoons striking from every quarter.
Yeah, blue, blue, blue.
Yes.
Now, it's interesting when we turn to movies. Are there now, can one speak anymore? Certainly Godard did the styles of other filmmakers, sometimes with great malice. But are there now practitioners who are good enough to be tinkering with the styles of the people they admire or their deplore?
The question should also be, are there practitioners who could be confident of an audience who would pick up that? In other words, who won't, you know, what you don't want is either be doing it in a void purely for your own pleasure because nobody's going to recognize it, nor do you want to be merely doing it for show, to show to a few people. I think even in Everything You Always Want to Know About Sex, Woody Allen has like an Antonioni parody, doesn't he, with people walking back and across the room and the camera staying there. And that's unthinkable now because nobody would know what Antonioni movie looks like. What happens now, I think, there's a much simpler and, in a way, I mean, very, very skilled, but less provoking form of imitation, whereby there are jump cuts going on in everyday American movies now, which once would have been surprising in a way that Godard was surprising. And it's all of Godard's fears comes true, you know. Ingestion has happened, and the mainstream has swallowed his, these small sort of tributaries of style. I'm not sure you could. If there are parodies now in American movies, they tend to parody in very, very obvious ways. I remember thinking in one of the Naked Gun movies, there's a parody of the Brian De Palma scene in The Untouchables with the baby buggy going down the steps. What people probably in the sitting audience may not know was that of itself, of course, was a parody of the Odessa steps sequence in Battleship Potemkin. So this lovely idea that you end up with Leslie Nielsen imitating Eisenstein. This is something has happened here. Although I do have to say that I think the funniest moment in American movies in the last 20 years was in Naked Gun 2.5. You'll be appalled to hear this, Michael, but in the credits of that, it was a Zucker Abrams movie, the guys who did David Zucker, who did Airplane, and it's at the beginning it does say Leslie Nielsen and Priscilla Presley in Un film de David Zucker. And I think that is a very great joke, because it, suddenly the whole of the auteur theory and the whole of the Prince of Orange is blown wide open in front of you. And I laughed for about half an hour at that, because if anyone who's watched French films love them, it's the whole thing. And he was joking at his own expense, because he knew that one thing, he was not the auteur. And so it's even unlikely places, that's the other thing. You should, you know, if you have to review movies, go and see everything you can, because in the unlikeliest places you will find a good joke, you know, or one scene that will, you know, that will stand out and stay with you. And I think that's not necessarily true of reviewing theatre. I think if you go to a play and it starts to stink, you know, the stink will carry on. And you're unlikely, it's going to get worse the evening. And there's almost no greater pleasure, philistine though it may be, than that of leaving a play halfway through at the interval while it's still light, knowing you're going to get a restaurant table. Whereas you could stay with a bad movie and just out of nowhere, towards the end, there could be one scene that suddenly takes fire, or one character who wanders in and has a small part, or one song. And it may say something not entirely flattering about the nature of movies, about their almost wanton lack of coherence sometimes, but it's worth staying the course. You know,
you've put into my mind something, I think, that I hadn't thought of before. By the way, I'm speaking to Anthony Lane. His collection of criticism, both movie reviews and book reviews and profiles, is published by Knopf. Nobody's Perfect, from Alfred A. Knopf. One of the few things you still do see parodied is Alfred Hitchcock.
Of course, yes.
And it could be in movies that the only way that parody will work is if you found someone who has been interested in the art, in quotes, of cinema, but also interested in courting a huge popular audience. And so, weirdly, when they did that Color Psycho, it was as if the way to both parody and comment on Hitchcock was simply to replicate him.
Yeah. No, it was like, that film was like Warhol, wasn't it? I mean, it was, Hitchcock, he may well be unique in this respect, I think. It also raises the question of whether how he managed to repeat himself without himself becoming self-parodical, which he very rarely did. How does a manner repeat itself without becoming a mannerism? There's a point in the book where I talk about sending a friend down who knew about Hitchcock but hadn't seen Marnie, and I said, "Okay, I'm going to show you the tape of a movie. I want to tell me who directed it." And so I switched it on, and I timed him. I had a stopwatch. And the movie started, and he said, "Alfred Hitchcock." And I checked the stopwatch, and it was 12 seconds.
Now, I'm very interested, and this is one of the fields that you don't really dabble into in the course of the book. When you come within four or five reviews to the review of Jacques Rivette's Divertimento, one is instantly aware that the tone is very different. And yet, there's consistently an acknowledgement that these films are for very few people. When you're reviewing Sebald, you are comforting or consoling the frightened would-be reader that he is not, in fact, as difficult as it might look.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I wish I didn't have to do that, but I think you, and it certainly isn't intended, I would hate to think it comes across as condescension. It's just, you know, the aisle is full of noises, you know. I mean, we can hardly hear ourselves think a lot of the time, and to make the space and time to sit down and watch a Rivette film or read Sebald, you know, I find I need all the encouragement I can get. You know, if I'm listening to the radio or a friend mentions to me something, I'm very grateful for that, because it's a tip saying, you know, you must go and read this. I found someone, a friend of mine the other day, who hadn't read Sebald, and she was almost kind of scared to do so. She said, "I've heard he's great. Should I do it? It's kind of an undertaking." I said, "It is a serious undertaking. You're going to have to kind of cut other stuff out for a while. You know, it's a heavy diet." Having said that, it's not as heavy a diet as you might be led to believe by his reputation. Sebald, who died recently, you know, has left us a small body of work, which, as I said when he died, you know, if you're going to make bets, he's as good a bet as anybody. I think, for who we'll be reading in a couple of centuries' time. But Rivette, now, this is a difficult case in point. This movie you were talking about, Divertimento, is a two-hour cut of originally a four-hour movie. Now, a lot of this form movie is taken up with Emmanuel Bayard standing there without any clothes on at all. So there are, you know, there are consolations to be had. Although the look she gives the viewer as she takes off her clothes is so challenging, so kind of how dare you even, you know, think of being lascivious towards me, that you may be thrown back in your seat with fear. But even then we should be grateful, because Rivette once made a movie which is 13 hours long, which even I, you know, coward that I am, have not quite managed to see, and which apparently has never been shown without technically coming apart, like projectors blowing up and so forth. The two-hour cut is, you know, is full of grace notes. It's full of levity. It's full of, has Jane Birkin in it. What I hate is the idea that there is this citadel of hard, difficult art movies, and outside, you know, this easy, rolling countryside of the mainstream movies. There are moments in supposedly hard art movies which are thrilling and funny and exciting, and there are longers and difficulties in mainstream cinema, which, you know, which are every bit as intractable as things that are going on in the art house. If you watch a film like A Man Escaped, which is my favourite film by Robert Bresson, indeed one of the greatest films ever made, I think. I mean, it's like watching it. It is a thriller to some extent. It's about a prison break. It's, you know, it's far more exciting than Shawshank, genuinely so. When at the end, when they're over the wall, you're kind of leaping out of your seat. And, yes, and Bresson wants you to think that. It's about jubilation, and he plays a Mozart mass at the end to indicate that.
You and I are on the same side. Bresson, one of my favourite filmmakers, and A Man Escaped, one of my favourite films. For me, Rivette is the opportunity to see what the Oulipo would look like if it were on screen, although Georges Perec made some movies himself. But throughout this collection, and this is the first time I've seen it, here's a critic, Anthony Lane, capable of looking at these movies. There are many critics who are no longer capable of it, who just throw up their hands, who nevertheless strews throughout the volume acknowledgments like Shakespeare doesn't mean much to many people anymore, Harold Bloom notwithstanding. We can go to a Project or to an Armani store and find an equal or perhaps greater number of people disinterested, uninterested in Shakespeare. It used to be that a critic didn't acknowledge and bow to the public disinterest. The critic's job was to create an interest in the public and to almost say that you're not alive sufficiently if you're not aware of the advances of the art
that's
form
just,
you love.
That, yeah, to say that, of course, is not even a moral fault. It's spiritual condescension to say that, you know, you're that given the choice, you know, this is not for you, is a terrible way to proceed.
No, this is for you, and you don't know it yet. Kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, and all a critic can do really is to say, you know, it is still worth your while. But it may be that, it may be to be Spenglerian about it all, this, that is, that one is fighting hopelessly there. But I prefer to remain hopeful that is not the case. That if you can get people in to see God out, or if they happen to pick up a book in someone else's house, which I always find is the best place to read to people one hasn't read before, not in one's own house, but other people's books, other people's book collections, or in their houses when you take them over on vacation, then it's worthwhile, then it's worth their while. And I just don't think you can just shut the gates of the stockade and say we're in here and you're out there. Movies have to be the lead-in for this, because I mean, I think if I was working in the era of classic music, I think, you know, despair would come upon one all the time, because the eras of crossover there have produced some of the worst music we've ever had and some of the worst marketing of any art ever seen. Crossover is one of those words which, you know, and concepts which should probably be banned from our vocabulary. In the movies, you know, when I go and see, you know, a big new movie, my excitement at going to see this new Jack Nicholson film called About Schmidt, which I hear is very good, or going to see Punch Drunk Love, the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie by the guy who made Magnolia, I'm going to those in exactly the same spirit as everybody else is going to go and see these movies. That has to be my trump card, as it were. You know, I'm sitting there And it may be that I've, as my vampire complexion would say, I've seen more of these things than many other people, but I've also seen a lot less movies than other people. I'm younger than a lot of people, so in my desire to line up, I see these things in as big a cinema as possible, with as many people as possible. I hope is, in some ways, gives me leave to write about them and gives me leave to urge people to go and see them.
Well, I think that is certainly true. What I'm objecting to here is a tone that, and sometimes a weary acceptance of the minority position when it once was that the critic would be beating the drum and making accessible and thrilling. Unfortunately, I know people who didn't hear Stravinsky until Pauline Kael said that The Last Tango in Paris
was like watching Rose of Spring. Yeah.
Yes.
If she led them to listen to Stravinsky, great. That's a great
That's what I mean. She never thought to say you will find Last Tango in Paris as difficult as you find Stravinsky, or you probably don't care about.
And she was taking
Stravinsky.
Advantage of the fact that Stravinsky is not as hard. If you're listening to Stravinsky after listening to all the music that's coming between, it's still going to be shocking. I think it's still a violent piece of work, as violent as ever, but it's not inaccessible. It's all too accessible. I think it beats a path straight to your cortex. And I think it's a sign of the great works of modernism. They as I write about in the book, when I'm writing about Bunuel and Chien Andalou, these things remain shocking, and they should remain shocking. And shock is one of the if there is a shock of the new, that is one of the best things about the new. And in a way, I find I'm disappointed the extent to which I'm not shocked a lot of the time now, because and a lot of what one is told is going to be shocking. It leaves one sort of
appalled.
Well, a little limp with lack of interest, really. Pauline Kael was among her many virtues, but she absolutely didn't want to lock herself away with movies and movies alone.
Among the many things that you will come to know if you read Anthony Lane's book, I'm referring to a title of an Isaac Babel collection, You Must Know Everything, and Donald Barthelme liked to echo that when asked, what should a writer know? Well, you must know everything. He compares Quentin Tarantino's dialogue to that of Ivy Compton Burnett.
I think I'd like to see Tarantino filming Ivy Compton Burnett. I should think.
I'd like to see any film
exploding
of Ivy Compton Burnett.
Beating each other to death with cucumber sandwiches. I think it'd be great.
There's an essay by on Edward Lear, Vladimir Nabokov, Cyril Connolly, T.S. Eliot, Matthew Arnold, Gide, Waugh, Ruskin. I'm a little bit astonished that you are as fond of A.E. Housman as you are, but to each his own.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's much more fun to read things with which one can profoundly disagree. I think Pauline Kael, amongst others, taught us that. Housman is very much an acquired taste, and all the more reason to try and persuade other people why they might, if only temporarily, acquire it. There was a stop-odd play about Housman which turned me back towards Housman. And the pleasure of reading him, and the kind of character Housman assumes in one's mind was made me convinced that he was, and the dryness of him made me convinced that he was, worth proselytizing for. I like it when you say for some, A. Housman, even though that may be against the grain of your taste, because it's the grain that interests me in a way. I like people who quarrel with themselves, who are prepared to go against their own grain, as it were.
I'm delighted by essays, articles that sound as if a more modern Noel Coward has leaned over the shoulder to intone, "What is the point of Demi Moore?" And I'm curious about the humor writers who seem to have really strongly influenced the style. You mention in the review of The Remains of the Day that it's a book that it's hard for you to take seriously because P.G. Woodhouse
says... Rem Akutagisti, as Jeeves says to Bertie, in a way the whole book is about Woodhouse, and there's hardly any there is hardly a mention of Woodhouse in the book, but that's what the book is about. And for the last 10 years I've been promising a piece about Woodhouse to the New Yorker. I was actually asked if I wanted to write his biography, which I didn't do for various reasons, mainly because I'm not that interested in his life. But Woodhouse,
about
I'm afraid, is
about chickens, huh?
Yeah, Woodhouse, I'm afraid, is the person who was responsible for the crime that is me, really. I inherited from my great uncle a complete set. He had two complete sets. He had two complete sets, one upstairs and one downstairs, so that he didn't have to change floors when he wanted to consult them.
Penguin is about to bring virtually everything back into print.
I suppose I've read him every day for the last 20 years.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Every day?
I would say so. I mean, if I skip a few days, or if I'm suddenly lost without him, you know, I have to kind of make up later, I reckon. I probably read him in the way that... I mean, the only things that I know as well as Woodhouse is probably the Liturgy of the Church of England, because that was the hymns and the Liturgy of the Church of England, you know, the hymns and psalms that, you know, if you're brought up as a chorister, you know, I can, hymns are like locked into my hard drive, you know, if you start him, I will finish it off for you, and the basic Liturgy of the Book of Common Prayer, and to my shame, that if that fades, it's been taken over by P.G. Woodhouse. But if you open the Jeeves omnibus and start a sentence, I could probably finish with, this is a terrible waste of a life. You know, I have many, but I should have been, you know, doing vast voluntary charity work overseas, or going around the world, or running terribly important companies in Silicon Valley. Instead of which, I've just been sitting reading stories called Pig Hooey and Heart of a Goof and things for all my life. I'm interested in what very great writers keep on their bedside tables. We know that Eliot, used Marvell and used Donne and used Dante. But what people don't know is that Eliot tend not to know so much, as Eliot was a Sherlock Holmes fanatic, and a Pickwickian also. Auden read Tolkien. These things can get into their work just as much their more obvious and solemn influences. And I think I know an awful lot of people who have either detective fiction or P.G. Woodhouse on their bedside table. There was one English writer who said that his czar was to die, be found dead in his bed with a copy of Woodhouse open next to him, having read it last thing at night, and was indeed found with a copy of, I think, Right Ho Jeeves open next to him, and apparently with a smile on his face, which I think is the way that I myself too, whether in the near or distant future, would like to go.
I've been speaking to Anthony Lane. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. His
book, Nobody's Perfect, is a collection of the essays, reviews for The New Yorker. They are extraordinary. He's the most recent example of the critic who really can write and knows more than the subject at hand, so it's a pleasure to read him. The book, once again, is Nobody's Perfect, published by Knopf. Thank you for joining me. You can read the introduction of Nobody's Perfect on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book of the mouse.